Today on the show, we're recapping some of the key news and notes from NBA Media Day, and then Alex Golden joins later in the show to discuss some of the Central Division teams and what we saw from their Media Days. That's all coming up right now. NBA teams had their media days on Monday, so let's go through some of those today, and we'll get to more later in the week. And let's start off, of course, with the LA Clippers, because on Monday morning, Pablo Torre released another podcast with more information about the scandal around Kawhi Leonard and Aspiration. And this time, he found out that in December of 2024, Steve Ballmer donated $1.875 million to a charity led by, of course, Aspiration's co-founder, Joe Sandberg. And that was in December 2024, more than a year after the Clippers say that they ended their relationship with Aspiration, while it was clear that was a company going bankrupt, while it was clear that company had scammed people. And yet, a $1.875 million donation had gone to his charity, Golden State Opportunity. No evidence necessarily that any of that money was diverted to Kawhi Leonard. But again, circumstantial, interesting, and strange timing as well. And the Clippers had their media day. Of course, later in the day on Monday, everybody and their mother is asked about everything that had happened. Lawrence Frank was at the podium, and he was asked a heck of a lot about it as well. And he said simply, "We know the rules." We know the rules. The big quote, the larger quote that he had, though, besides that was, "We expect the investigation will show that these allegations are wrong. We are eager for the whole truth, the whole picture to be revealed. We're very confident in what that will show." He had another one as well, where he said, "Our mission every day is to build the best team we can under the constraints of the cap. There is no gray area. There are no secret shortcuts. It's clear what we are and are not allowed to do. The accusations made against us are serious, and they don't line up with my experience, my reality." Okay. No surprise, of course. It's denial, denial, denial from Lawrence Frank. The thing is that this team 10 years ago was fined for cap circumvention. This is the Clippers' reality. They were investigated 6 years ago involving Uncle Dennis and his demands, and that's where there wasn't a denial from Lawrence Frank, because at one point he was asked if Uncle Dennis Robinson, Kawhi Leonard's uncle slash, you know, pseudo agent, had made any demands outside of the salary cap, and he said, "We know the rules." He didn't deny. He didn't say no. He just said, "We know the rules. Uncle Dennis knows the rules. Kawhi knows the rules." Look, there's no clear cut, you know, hardcore email from Steve Ballmer saying, "You got to pay him. We're giving you this because you need to do this." There's none of that. But this is circumstantial evidence that, as I got into last week with the NBA, they can request tax records if necessary from Kawhi and from the Clippers, under the rules of the collective bargaining agreement that were agreed to between the NBA, their owners, and with the Players Association. We know that for a fact. And we know that they are able to fine or hand out some type of penalty to the Clippers if there is circumstantial evidence that cannot be met with a reasonable explanation for what had happened. And so far, I'm not seeing much reason for any of these payments. And for the Clippers situation here, what a shame. You got this really fun roster, even though they're old as hell, and this is all anybody's going to be talking about, because why else will we talk about anything else at this point with the Los Angeles Clippers until the games actually begin? Because at this point, it's just going to be a matter of, is Kawhi even going to be under contract? Would they rescind that deal? Would they do what they did with Joe Smith and the Minnesota Timberwolves 20-plus years ago? Will there be fines with draft picks being removed from the Clippers? Could there be suspensions? We don't know what's going to happen here. But the NBA is indeed investigating, and we'll see if Lawrence Frank and Steve Ballmer are on the right side of this, or if it's going to be Pablo Torre and his investigation with everything he's released on his podcast. In other news, Anthony Davis was at the podium, and we saw his eye for the first time ever since he underwent retinal detachment surgery this offseason, and very red in the right eye. He said that's because of some eye drops that he's taking. I'm very familiar with the retina because, unfortunately, my mom has undergone five retinal detachment surgeries in her life, 3 on one eye, 2 on the other. It's like it is not a surgery you want to have to go through. It is not a recovery you want to have to go through. And so for AD this year, he did say that he's going to be wearing goggles for the rest of his NBA career, which is no surprise, because if you do suffer a retina detachment, any trauma to the head puts you at risk of re-detaching that retina. So for example, with my mom, anytime she's in the car with me, I am extra, extra cautious, because any accident would put her at risk of suffering another detachment. And considering the amount of surgeries she's had already, that risks her losing her vision entirely. And so for Anthony Davis, hopefully he has no blind spots in his eye, which is possible from the surgery that you can receive, or where they cut in, a blind spot can occur. But ultimately, he says his vision is fine. He'll be wearing the goggles. I do worry about, you know, him getting hit in the head, you know, the physical contact, especially as a big man. Could that cause injury as well? But there's been plenty of NHL players in the past that have suffered retina injuries that have been able to return. So hopefully for AD, he has no issues. Hopefully that's the case. But ultimately for him, this season in Dallas, that is going to be something to monitor. When does he return? We still don't even know a lot of the details. I've tried doing some digging here. I've yet to find out exactly when the injury occurred, when the surgery happened. Why is he not ready to play yet? What is the timeline here? There will be more to be revealed. I'm hoping to still dig up more and find out more with Anthony Davis here. But I'm not sure how solid it's going to be, because the Mavericks can't even get their story straight with anything. Jason Kidd, during his media day presser on Monday, had a very strange quote where he was asked about Kyrie Irving being ahead of schedule. And Jason Kidd said, "That's bad reporting. He is doing quite well, as we can see, but he's not ahead of schedule." But it was Nico Harrison himself during Summer League who said Kyrie's ahead of schedule, but we kind of knew he would be because of the way he attacks his rehab. So Nico said literally in July that Kyrie is ahead of schedule, but Jason Kidd, as Kidd says today in late September, that's bad reporting. I'm not sure there's much you can trust that comes out of Dallas at this point in time. So ultimately, we'll see with Kyrie. He is on the floor already. Hopefully he's able to return. And I think, as AD also said during his presser, once Kyrie comes back, he feels like they can be a finals contender. We'll see about that. There's a lot of ifs with this team. If AD can stay on the floor, if Kyrie Irving can come back and be himself, if Cooper Flagg can be great right away as a rookie. A lot of ifs with the Dallas Mavericks, but they are certainly going to be one of the more interesting teams in the NBA. Another team that I'm fascinated to watch this season is the Denver Nuggets. The Denver Nuggets, I can't wait to see them play this year, because with Denver, you get Jonas Valanciunas, the best backup of Jokic's career. And David Adelman, their head coach, said during his media day presser today that he thinks we could see Jokic and Valanciunas together on the floor this season. And I know on one hand you could say, well, that defense is going to be horrible with two interior centers out there on the floor. Yeah. That's true, for sure. But this team could ground and pound on offense. They could just rebound 55-60% of misses like the Adam Şengün front court did last year for Houston. It gives them another tool. And that's one of the themes I'm most fascinated by in the NBA this season. Lineup flexibility, teams moving back towards having two big lineups. What Houston did last year, one of the reasons why they were able to go deep in the series against the Warriors, despite having a crappy half-court offense, was because of the offensive boards with Şengün and Adams. So the Nuggets already have a brilliant offense with Jokic. They already have an amazing offense that they can run their standard system. But what happens now if you have two bigs out there? By the way, both of them can shoot threes. Valanciunas and Jokic can. Both of them great interior players as well. What does that look like? What wrinkle does that add? Maybe it does struggle defensively and it may become something that you decide not to use. But I think lineup versatility is something Denver really hasn't had. And if you have this ability to play Jokic and Valanciunas, or Adelman didn't say this, if Daron Holmes is able to be really good in his true rookie season now after missing all of last year, he's a versatile big who can defend a little bit on the perimeter. You can play with those two bigs as well. You can play with JV plus Jokic, or Jokic plus Holmes, or Valanciunas plus Holmes, or just one of those guys out there. the Nuggets, suddenly this team has a lot more flexible options that they can play. And never mind the ability to play with no bigs and play with Aaron Gordon at the five. And so with the Nuggets, I can't wait to see Adelman hopefully experiment over the course of the regular season, because some of the stuff isn't going to work. A lot of it might. And another team that I'm fascinated by with lineup flexibility is the Rockets. But for before we get to that, KD did say he intends to re-sign with the Rockets long term. That was the big news from Rockets media day. He's in the final year of his contract. He at least plans on re-signing with them. And I would imagine for him, he wanted to go to Houston. They were on his list. Why would he not, with their potential? One of the reasons I'm so bullish on the Rockets this year is their lineup flexibility. And unprompted today, Ime Udoka, their head coach, brought up one of the potential lineups that you could see from Houston this year. And that was a lineup that included all five guys being large, long-armed wing players plus two bigs. Steven Adams, Alperen Şengün, plus Jabari Smith, Kevin Durant, and Amen Thompson. Udoka brought up this lineup as one of the, he said in his words, one of the biggest lineups in the history of the league. So if Ime is bringing up the idea of that without even being necessarily asked about this funky, weird, creative group, I'm sure we're going to see it from him. We're going to see this group at some point, maybe even on opening night against the Oklahoma City Thunder. And that just gets me fired up. I just can't wait to see a group like this out there, because you got a mix of shooting, KD, Jabari Smith. You got interior guys that can pound the boards, Şengün and Adams. Hopefully Şengün can shoot a little bit as well. I'm not optimistic about Amen Thompson, but he brings speed and versatility. This team is long. You could play zone on defense. Offensively, there's just so many different players you can play through, so many different ways you can play. And of course, this whole Rockets team, they have a bunch of different lineups that they can play with, whether it's a Reed Shepherd group out there, whether it's a traditional lineup with just one of the bigs out there. There's a lot of different combos you'll see from Houston this season. But I just hope, you know, one of the things with Oklahoma City winning the finals last year was how Mark Daigneault used the entire regular season to experiment. He talked about it openly with playing, you know, Chet Holmgren and Isaiah Hartenstein in situations where it didn't make sense, where it didn't make sense to play those guys because they were practicing for the playoffs, preparing for situations in which they'd have to use those guys where it wasn't the perfect ideal situation. The West might be loaded if you're Houston and Denver and Minnesota and all these teams where you losing one game could mean losing home court. But giving yourself these reps and opportunities over the course of the season is what could actually end up leading to greater success and more wins and more playoff success. And so the fact that you have these coaches, Adelman in Denver, Udoka in Houston, talking about playing these offbeat lineups, that gets me really excited for what it's going to be like to watch these teams on a night-to-night basis during the season from an excitement standpoint. Like, you don't know what you're going to see. What you're going to see could be fun and innovative and exciting. But also, from just a tactical standpoint, how do these decisions over the course of the year impact their finals odds and therefore impact their chances to win a championship? So those are just two of a number of lineup-driven, you know, thoughts coaches revealed on Media Day that I'm excited about. From a player standpoint, DeAndre Ayton had a quote that stood out to me today, because DA, of course, out of Portland, Phoenix wanted him gone, Devin Booker wanted him out, Kevin Durant wanted him out, and now he finds his way in Los Angeles with LeBron James and Luka Doncic. And DeAndre Ayton had a great quote where he said, "Some people say it's my last leg. Some people say it's my last chance. But it's an opportunity I can say I'm not going to take for granted. It's almost like a wounded animal. I feel all the tension and I know where I'm at. I've been in the gym every day." And, you know, this is just talk. Ayton's going to prove it, of course, over the course of the season. But it's true. Like, this is true. This is the opportunity of a lifetime for him to be playing with LeBron and Luka. So not only are you in a situation now where you're still getting paid out by Portland and you're on a cheap deal with the Lakers, but this is an opportunity to win this year, and it's an audition for your future. A, to get another big money contract, and B, to be the center that's attached to Luka when we've seen what he can do for centers. The easy shots and opportunities he can create for you, even if you're just a mid-level center. DeAndre Ayton has shown he can be much, much more than that when he's locked in, when he is completely, completely invested with bringing effort, as we saw at his peak with Phoenix that year they went to the finals and lost to the Milwaukee Bucks. Ayton has that in him. And with Luka, this is an opportunity here to show what you can do, not just this season, but to show that you can be the guy that's attached to Luka for the next decade, the Lakers would hope. And so for him, if he does screw up this opportunity, like what more are you going to get? Like, what more do you want? This is the best opportunity of your career to win in the short term, but also be attached to Luka legend, a guy who is blossoming and will eventually win a championship in the years to come. So for DA, if the Lakers get 18 and 10 out of him and versatile defense, he's the swing piece. He's the guy that can turn this team into a championship contender this season. Let's talk about the Warriors, because they have gotten commitments from Al Horford, Gary Payton II, and De'Anthony Melton to re-sign with the team once, you know, this whole Jonathan Kuminga saga is over and done with, which still no clarity there. He was not at media day for the Warriors today. He is still not with the team. Stephen Curry and others talked about Kuminga. Butler said he expects a full commitment, that it's all going to work out. Stephen Curry said he's been told by Kuminga that he will be committed once he's with the team. We'll see. We'll see about all this. It's just such a mess for the Warriors, and this team is just so old. They're such an old team. The meme posted on social today by Sam Esfandiari from Light Years Ahead, I thought was perfect, where you get the meme of the Warriors a few years ago, where it's Stephen Curry bringing on Jordan Poole and Jonathan Kuminga and Moody and Wiseman, all these kids. And now it's a bunch of old guys, Al Horford, Draymond Green, Jimmy Butler, Gary Payton II, among other old players on this team. I just don't see it. I just don't see it with the Warriors. And Steph is one of the best politicians in the NBA. And I say that as a compliment to him, because you need to be media savvy. He is one of the best at saying things with a smile on his face. But boy, I would love to get Stephen Curry's unfiltered thoughts on this whole mess the Warriors find themselves in. I would love to know what Steph really thinks about Jonathan Kuminga, who's proven nothing in his career, holding out in the way he is. I'd love to know what he thinks about the Warriors completely botching this whole mess and not having these guys signed to actual contracts when it's September 29th, it's media day. I'd love to know what Stephen Curry really thinks about all this. I'd love to know what Jimmy Butler, who's burned bridges with every team he's ever been on, really thinks about the situation he finds himself in with his franchise can't seem to get things straight with this middling player in Jonathan Kuminga, and have yet to be able to re-sign their veterans and get things going this offseason as training camp has started. I'd love to know what these guys really, really think about this situation, because from the outside looking in, I think it's a mess. Every executive I text with kind of chuckles about it, where they look at this great dynasty that has collapsed as they've lost some key figures from the organization. Look, I last year said the Warriors should consider trading Stephen Curry and Draymond Green for a haul rather than going out and getting Jimmy Butler. I wouldn't go that far yet. I wouldn't say that yet today, because they got Butler for cheap. I love the Al Horford fit with the Warriors. Al Horford, he might be old, but he is still a damn good basketball player. He is still a great shooter, a great facilitator, still a great defensive player. I mean, Al Horford doing this in his late 30s, that I can't fathom it, after he looked completely washed up over a half decade ago when he had his single year with the Philadelphia 76ers. Horford's still good. Butler's still good. Draymond's still good. Steph is still great. They have something there. They're just missing. They're missing one more guy. And I think for the Warriors, that's the reason why they're making things so difficult here with Kuminga. So I'm not ready to say that again with Steph and Draymond yet, but I wouldn't rule it out, it becoming a thing midseason again, at least from my perspective, because this Warriors team, I'm not seeing it. I'm not seeing it until we see either Kuminga take a leap or Kuminga get flipped for something else. And if that doesn't happen, this team is not competing for a finals in the Western Conference. It is just not realistic from them. All right, let's talk about some more media day things that happened with teams in the Central Division with today's guest, Alex Golden. That's coming up right now. And we'll be right back after this break. All right, let's preview the Central Division teams now with Alex Golden. Alex, how you doing today, man?
KOC, it's good to be here. Thanks for having me on. A big time fan of yours, and I appreciate the invite.
I appreciate it, man. You primarily, of course, cover the Indiana Pacers. So let's start off there with Indiana. Their offseason, of course, Tyrese Haliburton, unfortunately, still recovering from a torn Achilles, likely to miss the entire season, he said at Media Day today. The Pacers lose Miles Turner. They lose Thomas Bryant. They bring in Jay Huff, Monty Morris to help out in the backcourt. They draft Cam Jones and Talen Peter as well. And so, you know, you look at the Pacers offseason, not a lot of big names that are going to impact the rotation necessarily, but it's the losses with Miles Turner that are most shocking now, with Jay Huff, Isaiah Jackson, and James Wiseman is likely centers, Pascal Siakam and Andrew Nembhard, Aaron Nesmith, Obi Toppin, a lot of familiar names, but not having Tyrese Haliburton here, Alex. Boy, it just doesn't feel quite the same after the team was in a game 7 of an NBA Finals. Tell me, like, what's the temperature of Pacers fans right now when they look at the team today minus Haliburton?
I think that they're still excited. I obviously coming off a high from being in game 7, and every Pacer fan will tell you if Haliburton doesn't get hurt, they think they actually win the championship against OKC. And so there's obviously a big debate on that. I mean, OKC was pretty spectacular all season long, but it was a really good NBA Finals, and the Pacers were just having that magical run. Obviously, no Haliburton means opportunity here for Andrew Nembhard, and I think that that's what we want to see is just, can he kind of carry that load? You know, Jay Huff, Isaiah Jackson, James Wiseman, all three are really competing for that center spot with the loss of Miles Turner. So a lot of question marks here for the Pacers, because I've got some big holes to fill with two starters from a team that made it to the NBA Finals not returning. But I think that losing Haliburton obviously is a much bigger loss than Miles Turner. I think that if Haliburton were healthy, you could probably get away with having a different center and still make it pretty far.
Yeah, I mean, ultimately, as you said up top, this is going to be a year of opportunity for Andrew Nembhard, Ben Mathurin, Ben Shepherd. Like, where do these touches get distributed? Aaron Nesmith, maybe we see a little bit more from him as well. Just all the opportunity that's going to come with Haliburton not being the guy running the show here. And Nembhard's going to be the number one guy we're going to see a lot of opportunity for. And with the Pacers, I think that's what's interesting, because, of course, this team isn't going to have finals expectations without Tyrese. That goes without saying. But I do feel like it's right to still feel excitement for the season, as you're saying Pacers fans are feeling right now, because maybe there ends up being blessings in disguise here for an Andrew Nembhard if he's able to take a leap, a Ben Mathurin with all the opportunity that's going to come. What are you ultimately going to be looking for here, Alex? Like, what's the number one thing you want to see from Andrew Nembhard this season with all the opportunity he's going to get without Haliburton out there?
Yeah, I just think for me personally, I want to see this group develop, because they've played well in the system that they've played with Rick Carlisle. I don't think that's going to change too much. They're going to have to change their pace a little bit, just because Nembhard's not the same type of player as Tyrese Haliburton. But at the end of the day, you want to see growth from a guy like Andrew Nembhard. You want to see if he can actually run a team for 82 games in a regular season as that number one guy. Last year, we saw so many teams face guarding Tyrese Haliburton at half court, trying to take him out of the offense because of what he was doing for the Pacers. And that put a lot of pressure on Nembhard to kind of be that guy. And he actually did it pretty well. So I think he's already got that confidence and that experience already as running the point guard. So it's not going to be as hard to me for him to kind of embrace that. I think Mathurin's just one of those guys that is just locked in. This is a contract year for Mathurin. He's a restricted free agent. He wants to kind of prove, like, hey, I deserve a pretty big payday. I can be a starter in this league. He's been up and down in terms of being a starter, being a six-man type of player. He even mentioned it today at Media Day, like, there's times in the playoffs where he would play 6 minutes, 17 minutes, or 30 minutes, and he just never knew what to expect. But whatever was asked of him is what he wanted to do. And so I think just him continuing to buy in with this team is huge. And a name you haven't brought up that I think could actually have a huge impact on the pace of this year is third-year player Jairus Walker. I think Walker is one of those guys at 6'8". He shot the ball incredibly well from three last year for the Pacers. They like his upside defensively. That's what he was drafted for out of Houston. And if he can, you know, show some of that and show some flashes, like, are there times where maybe they're closing the game with him on the floor instead of an Obi Toppin or Isaiah Jackson, or maybe he's playing in that spot for Ben Mathurin defensively because he's just taken that leap. So I think that there's a lot of excitement around some of those third year, fourth year guys for the Pacers. Ben Shepherd, I think we kind of know what Ben Shepherd is. I wouldn't say that he's a bad player at all. I think he really fits the system well, but I think his ceiling is kind of what it is. He's not really going to put the ball on the floor. He's more of a catch and shoot guy, but you know, they really like the potential of Jairus Walker, and everybody had glowing reviews about Johnny Furphy in the summer he's had. So Rick Carlisle straight up said, I love him. So we'll see if he cracks the rotation as well. I don't think he'll technically get into that 10-man rotation, but I think Furphy is a guy that could be on the outside looking in. And if he gets an opportunity, people might be, wow, I didn't realize Furphy was that good.
You were at Pacers Media Day on Monday. Was there any indication from Carlisle or anything that he said that kind of made your ears perk up about some of these young guys? Like you mentioned Jairus Walker. Did anything stand out that Carlisle said?
You know, not a whole lot. It was more so just the continued conversation with Ben Mathurin. He's got to be quicker on his reads and just make the right plays, because too often the Pacers like to play this quick, fast-paced basketball, random basketball, and Mathurin at times can kind of slow the offense down and be more of an isolation scorer. He's a little bit different in terms of what they do, but sometimes different can be good, and they're going to need his scoring and his ability to attack the rim. So I think expectations for Mathurin are just, they're so high from a lot of fans, and I think Carlisle has always kind of tempered those expectations because he's expecting a higher level. And the one thing he did talk about too is Andrew Nembhard's defense, right? This is a guy that was guarding the opponent's best player most of the time last season. With him having an increased role on offense, does he continue to have those same defensive assignments? Because he's going to get exhausted if he's trying to carry the team offensively as the one for 30 minutes a game while also guarding the other team's best player. So that's where guys like Mathurin, Nesmith, and Jairus Walker have to step up defensively to kind of alleviate some of that load that's going to be on them.
I got to say this. I am fired up for Jay Huff to get consistent opportunity, because I have loved Jay Huff a long time, ever since, you know, really early last season when with Memphis, I felt like he should have been more of a fixture in the rotation. He was getting up and down minutes. I'd imagine we're going to see more consistent opportunity for him with Indiana, because there's just not a lot of 7'1" dudes that have true flamethrower jumpers from three. He shot over 40% from three last year on over three attempts per game and only 11 minutes per game. So he gets up a lot of shots from three, and it's not just like stand still, spot up, or pick and pop. He can shoot off of movement, shoot in motion, shoot off of a dead sprint, stop and go on transition. Like, he's super versatile from three as a 7'1" guy. And so I think with this Pacers offense, their style of play, even without Tyrese Halliburton, I can't wait to see what Jay Huff can do, Alex. That's one of the things I'm most excited about for the Pacers this year, is what's Jay Huff going to do?
Yeah, we haven't seen the large sample size from Jay Huff yet in his career, right? He's just kind of been like a third-string center, journeyman through the G League, and he talked about it at Media Day on Monday, like he's really appreciative of the G League and how it allowed him that opportunity to really grow, and he said that he really liked his time in Memphis and learned a lot there. So we'll see exactly if he starts or not. From what we heard in Media Day, Rick Carlisle said that Isaiah Jackson had been playing a lot of the scrimmage games with the starting five, so I think it's going to be Isaiah Jackson's.
Don't tell me that. Don't tell me that, Alex. That makes me very sad. I mean, all due respect to Isaiah Jackson. I know he's a lob guy, super fun player, but I want to see Jay Huff getting 30 minutes.
He does know the system a little bit better. He's been here since Carlisle was brought in as head coach. I think that was actually one of his first draft picks. So sure. Isaiah Jackson, he talked a lot about like what he can do in terms of setting screens and being very good at that pitch handoff that we saw Miles Turner kind of struggle with throughout the finals when OKC was pressuring so high. You know, Isaiah Jackson just uses that body a little bit differently. But we also know Pascal Siakam, when he was asked if he were to be traded or play with somebody in the front court, he mentioned Kevin Durant and Miles Turner. So I think he kind of likes having a floor spacing big next to him. But it's nice that the Pacers do have optionality. And like, the contract is so cheap for Jay Huff, it's hard to like fathom just like, wow, if you could really get him for, you know, playing at a high level for that cheap of a deal, it's great. But did you hear how Jay Huff found out about how he was getting traded to the Pacers?
No, I didn't hear that.
Okay, so at Media Day, they asked him, they're like, were you there anywhere like specifically? He said, me and my wife were hiding from either his parents or her parents in the pantry trying to scare them when they were coming home. And then he got a phone call from his agent saying, hey, you just got traded to the Pacers. So I thought it was pretty funny to say, hey, I was hiding in a pantry. And that's when I got called that I was getting traded. So the Jay Huff story is just, it's got a ton of aura.
Well, hopefully, I mean, for the Pacers centers, the season itself is as fun as that is, because Isaiah Jackson and James Wiseman both suffering serious injuries last year, both of them back, and then Miles Turner, you know, as soon as you think he's going to stay, he decides to bounce. Just kind of crazy that it's got.
Yeah, I mean, we'll talk about Miles and the Bucks, I'm sure, later in this podcast, but it was just, I think the Pacers were really shocked that Milwaukee was able to get that money to go ahead and snack him away. I think they were having some hard negotiations. We saw hard negotiations all summer long with different players, and some still haven't got new contracts as we're talking today. So I just think that with Miles Turner, it was one of those things where it's like, okay, this is a guy that really fits the system, but I feel like they had a number in mind because, you know, like if you saw what he did in the finals, it felt like every round of the playoffs, he did kind of digress a little bit. So I just think that the Pacers were trying to be smart with their money moving forward. And, you know, I don't think they saw Milwaukee coming in there with one of those contracts. But when asked about if the Pacers would have matched that, had they been given that opportunity, they never said, yes, we would have. They said, we would have liked the opportunity. So I think there's a little bit of, you know, reading the tea leaves there of what they're saying. So I don't think they're like losing sleep over it.
Tell me this, Alex. During the finals, the Pacers make a trade with the Pelicans and they get back their first round pick in 2026. This is before Tyrese Haliburton suffers his heartbreaking torn Achilles. So I can't imagine the Pelicans would have done that deal had they known what would happen with Tyrese Haliburton. With that said, the East is so weak, there's no guarantee that the Pacers will be a high lottery team or a lottery team at all. Are you thinking draft at all, or are you expecting this team to be in the play-in or even in the playoffs potentially with Indiana? What's your overall perception of that for Indiana this year? Are you thinking draft?
Yeah, I don't think so. I think with this team, they just have never really been a draft-heavy team, and they've got this city so fired up after making the finals. I think they want to show like, hey, we're here to compete. We're going to try to do our best to get into the playoffs. Even if we don't, we'll be a play-in team. And I think a lot of people have them around that 6-7-8 range, maybe even 9-10, just depending on how you view this team without Haliburton and Turner. But like you said, the Eastern Conference is pretty weak. I think there's a lot of holes on different teams, and the Pacers are pretty deep. And I think with Rick Carlisle, like we saw what he did in the playoffs with his coaching staff, like they just out-executed a lot of these teams, and I think they can do that throughout the regular season. They're going to be a pain to play like they have been for the last couple of years. People aren't going to enjoy it. And I think they're going to get more wins than people expect. I think Vegas has them around 37 wins is where they're projected at. I think they probably get 42, 43. I have them kind of penciled in at that sixth spot kind of for their ceiling. But, you know, I definitely think they're a play-in team, and I think they probably will win one of those play-in games just because even without Haliburton and without Turner, a lot of these guys have already experienced so much high-level playoff basketball. They know what it takes to win.
Let's move on to the Milwaukee Bucks. The Bucks had their media day on Monday, and Giannis, from Greece, because he has COVID, spoke over Zoom to media members. And we saw Miles Turner as well make his first appearance with Milwaukee this year after he was their big, shocking, surprising addition this offseason for Milwaukee. They lose Damian Lillard, who they waived and stretched in order to create the space to get Turner. They lose Brooke Lopez. They lose Pat Connaughton. And they bring back a whole bunch of guys. When you look at their Bucks rotation this year, insert Miles Turner into the starting center spot in place of Brooke Lopez. And it's unclear who's going to start here. Kuzma, Gary Trent, AJ Green, Taurean Prince, Andre Jackson, Gary Harris they bring in as well, Kevin Porter, Ryan Rollins, Cole Anthony they add. There's a lot of guards and wings and forwards. It's unclear who's going to start around, I'd assume, Turner, Giannis, and Kuzma. Bobby Portis probably comes off the bench as a backup behind Turner. But either way, you look at this Bucks team, I'm a little bit confused with what exactly it's going to look like with Doc Rivers' system here, Alex. To me, that's the biggest question with the Bucks this year. How is he going to structure this rotation around Giannis? What do you think it needs to look like for Milwaukee to get back to the contending ways that Giannis says he desires?
Yeah, I think if you look at last year's playoffs against the Pacers, once Dame went down with that Achilles, we saw there for a small sample size, Giannis with a bunch of shooters can be really impactful. And I think that's kind of what they're going for here. You would like to see Kuzma maybe do a little bit more than he did in the playoffs. I mean, he was a pretty, you know, net negative for that team. But Gary Trent Jr. had two 37 or 30 point games. I mean, he was incredible in some of those moments. I thought AJ Green really stepped up and had some moments. Kevin Porter Jr. hit or miss for me. Ryan Rollins, I think, might be a little bit more of a steady point guard with that group. But I think you're going to have to see a lot of point Giannis. And maybe you go even double big with Bobby Portis and Miles Turner with Giannis playing the one and play some big zone defense and things like that. Because this is going to be a team that they're just a lot of random pieces. And I think if they all click together, they could make some sense together. But I am a little bit skeptical because I just think they're putting so much on Giannis. And I feel like Giannis has to have an MVP level season, which he does almost every year. But I mean, I'm talking winning the MVP for this team to not be a playing team. I don't like the surrounding pieces around them that much. I think they're solid players. But if you take Giannis off the court, who is scoring for this team? Is it Kevin Porter Jr.? Is it Gary Trent Jr.? I mean, I don't know. What are they going to do? I just feel like without having that Damian Lillard, Jrue Holiday, Chris Middleton type guard with this team, there's just a lot of question marks of where they're going to generate offense from without Giannis.
It's going to be, you know, how like Jokic always has like a plus 18, and then without Jokic, the Nuggets are like minus 15. It's going to be one of those types of splits with the Bucks this year in all likelihood, unless, you know, Kevin Porter has a big year, or unless Kyle Kuzma, you know, as a super six man role has a big year, which I just like, these are like really like non-serious things to expect from the Bucks. Like Cole Anthony wins six man of the year. Like, it's just not going to happen. It's not happening. I just don't see that as a scenario for the Bucks. And I think you're right. You're going to have to see a lot of point Giannis. And you said something that's interesting to me because I haven't, on my pod, a lot of the time I talk about two bigs, and, you know, I've asked the question with young teams like the Blazers, or can we see Klingon and Yang Hansen play together? Are we going to see, you know, a lot of teams kind of copy what the Rockets are trying to do with Steven Adams and Alperen Şengün? And even during media day, Ime Udoka talked about how with the Rockets this year, maybe they'll play jumbo lineups with Şengün and Adams out there, with KD and Jabari Smith and Amen Thompson, where it's like one of the biggest lineups in NBA history. And you said similar with the Bucks. Could we see a situation where it's Turner and Portis and Giannis out there with, you know, Kuzma and Trent or something like that, or Porter and Kuzma, or Porter and Green? Like, that's a big team across the board, one through five. And I think with the Bucks, maybe that's what they're going to have to do this year, with Doc Rivers being extremely creative with his lineup choices rather than sticking with traditional one big out there. Maybe you're playing two big jumbo size lineups, and then off the bench, maybe you're playing some small ball. Maybe it's like, you know, occasionally Portis, but maybe sometimes it's no bigs out there. There's just a lot of different combinations, and that's where, you know, I'm with you that I don't love the fits on paper around Giannis, because there's not a lot of certainty with shooting. Kuzma's an iffy shooter. Porter's an iffy shooter. Andre Jackson's a non-shooter. You know, a lot of these guys are up and down. Like Gary Trent, AJ Green, Gary Harris are good shooters, but then you lose something on defense with some of these guys. It's hard to find balance with your rotations. But to your point, maybe Doc, it's more so, rather than the question of point Giannis, it's the question of what lineups is he going to lean on and try to experiment with over the course of the season to give this team an edge that they otherwise don't have.
I think they're going to have to experiment quite a bit, because I feel like you're never going to know what you're going to get consistently, because a lot of these players, they're not those consistent level of stars. And I think that's where even Miles Turner, if that's your second best player, I have question marks about that. I saw Miles Turner as a second best player for the Pacers, and they were lottery bound. So I know Giannis is a much better player than Tyrese Halliburton on both ends of the floor, but Tyrese Halliburton has beaten Giannis's team the last two seasons in the playoffs. So I'm just saying, I think Giannis and Miles, they make a lot of sense. And I think Miles Turner, if you're looking at, oh, we replaced Brooke Lopez for Miles Turner, then yes, that's a great fit. But where is Damian Lillard? I know he wasn't going to play this year with the Achilles injury, but to wave and stretch him over the next 5 years, and now he's your third highest paid contract and he's not even on the roster, that to me is problematic. And I understand they're trying to get under, I know they got under the apron, and I know they're trying to just find ways to piece together shooters that make sense. But yeah, Doc's going to have his hands full in trying to find different things that work. And so the reason I was saying you're going to have to play zone is because I just don't think Giannis is quick enough laterally to guard wings on a consistent basis. And so maybe you have to play some 2-3 zone or some 3-2 zone and just use your size to your advantage. But, you know, we've seen this team is going to be fascinating. I think that they could win some games just because Giannis is that good. But in the games that he doesn't play, I think that's problematic, because I think if you look at the last 5 years, he's only played 70 plus games in one of those seasons. So if he's missing 15 games for the year, are they going to win those games and he doesn't play? I think they have to be really strategic about when they sit him and try to utilize, you know, his energy and not over, you know, overwhelm him with so much, asking him to do so much, because I just feel like, as great as he is, this roster to me, it's good. They got good players, but nobody on that level that's going to take them, in my opinion, to the second round of the playoffs.
Yeah, they get good players. They also have a lot of mid players. Like, that's just the reality. It's just a fact. Like, I think you can be the hardest core Bucks fan and acknowledge, like, there's a lot of mid players on this team. And that's where, like, it gets so interesting with Giannis Antetokounmpo in his little Zoom presser with Bucks media today. The quote that went super viral with him was when he said, "The same thing I've been saying my whole career. I want to be on a team that allows me and gives me a chance to win a championship. It is never going to change. I want to be among the best." And that quote, I think, summarizes a lot of the whole conversation around Giannis this summer and also everything that he said today. Because with Giannis, he's going to enter the season fully committed to the Bucks. We know that. That is going to happen. The question will be, is this team going to look good enough in January and in February for him to say, yeah, I have a chance to win a championship this year, or at least make the finals in the Eastern Conference? And if he doesn't feel that way, you're going to have teams continuing to call up the Bucks, trying to make significant offers to go out and get him. And maybe at that point, as Giannis said in his translated interview about a week or two ago, where he's like, he flipped it the other way, there's no guarantee that the Bucks would want to keep him long term if it's not in their best interest to keep him. And that's, I think, the side of things that so often is not discussed with Giannis. It's not just about what he wants for his future. It's about what the Bucks want for their future as a franchise. And if you're just going to be a middling 43-40 win team, wasting away years of one of the most talented, one of the greatest players we've ever had in the history of basketball, maybe at some point that offer of, you know, a really young, appealing player and 7 future first round draft picks or whatever it is becomes a more appealing route for you to take rather than continuing forward for Giannis. And again, like, we don't know that today, but it is something that I think is worth thinking about as we approach the season and look at what things could look like come January, come February. And, you know, ultimately, Alex, I think I would bet on Giannis staying through the season. It's just really hard to trade players making that much money mid-season. But the Bucks have so many questions and not a lot of evidence and not a lot of, I think, proof that Doc Rivers has the creativity as a head coach in order to get everything he can out of this roster that perhaps some of the elite coaches in the NBA might be able to.
Yeah, and I mean, I will just say this, like, the Bucks, they're in a tough spot, right? Because Drew Holiday, that season, when, or the way that things ended with Drew Holiday, he was just kind of like not enough offensively. Chris Middleton couldn't stay healthy, right? And so you have to kind of make these tough decisions.
It's a bummer.
You go out and get Damian Lillard, right? And then all of a sudden, Dame has a freak Achilles injury, and he has the blood clot issue before that. So I think they've just had some unfortunate injury luck as they've tried to prolong Giannis's tenure in Milwaukee. But you've got a guy that's top 5 in MVP voting every single season. It's hard to just say, hey, let's just trade him. Let's go out there and find a deal that makes a lot of sense for us, even if we have to tear it down, because that's just really hard to do. You don't get players like that. So I understand trying to piece it together and just see what can happen, especially if we talk about how weak the Eastern Conference is this year. Like, okay, maybe if I'm looking at it from the other side, maybe Giannis plays great. Maybe he balls out. Maybe everything clicks together and these guys are all hitting threes and you got 3 or 4 guys shooting close to 40% from three and they're just figuring it out. They're clicking. All of a sudden things look okay. You know, maybe Giannis has something here, but I do understand the predicament Milwaukee's management is in, because trying to trade away a top 5 player in the league, the best player in the Eastern Conference without a doubt, it is a little bit hard to just do that. And what offer is out there? I'm sure they would get tons of offers if they put them on the table, but is there anything that they really think is going to help them get back to this spot where they're at now potentially with him? I don't know. So I do understand it from that standpoint, but yeah, I do not love this team.
No, it's a tough situation. As you said, a lot of bad luck has occurred for the Bucks, and you know, they win a championship, they won one, and that's better than a lot of teams can say, considering how quickly windows can shut. It's fickle. The contention is in the NBA. We'll be right back. move on to the Cavaliers, another team that trying to get their first post-LeBron James championship. And we saw how difficult it was last season for them. They have this dominant regular season. They flame out in the playoffs, look like a completely inferior team compared to the Indiana Pacers. Kenny Atkinson, after the series, I've referenced this many times on the pod at this point, basically just said, you know, in a nutshell, they're tough. We're not. Like that was like the really like Spark Notes version of what Atkinson said with this team. They didn't make a lot of changes, but they made some notable changes. They bring in Lonzo Ball, Larry Nance Jr., who I love, Thomas Bryant as well. They get him from Indiana. They lose Ty Jerome, who was not so good in the playoffs after a really good regular season. And they lose Isaac Okoro, who can't shoot. So overall, the Cavaliers' new look rotation, I like the changes they made, Alex. I think on paper, this team has versatility in the front court, versatility at the wing. DeAndre Hunter, Max Strus, Dean Wade, Sam Merrill, a lot of guys there. Larry Nance, we've seen him play center. We've seen him play forward. They have a bunch of guys that can play different positions. And, of course, Mitchell, Garland, now Lonzo Ball in the backcourt. This team has versatility. The big question is, can Kenny Atkinson get out of this team what he saw with Indiana with toughness and aggression from opening tip to the final buzzer, minute one through minute 48? Does this team have that guts, that intensity in them? And to me, I think all the changes in the offseason, we won't get the answer to that until we see this team take on that identity over the course of the season. Do you think that's a fair question in my mind with the Cavaliers this year?
No, I definitely think it is, because I go back to last season when the Pacers were playing the Cavs. They had like a back-to-back, basically like a Sunday in Cleveland, then a Tuesday in Indiana. And the Pacers, Halliburton got hurt at halftime. They start Ben Shepherd. They were down like 15 points. They come back and beat Cleveland. And the next game, Kenny Atkinson said, yeah, I watched what Rick Carlisle had to say. And he talked about how they played with force, and that's what got him back into the game. And at that point, that's when I kind of realized, oh, is this team tough enough? Because if Kenny Atkinson has to steal stuff from Rick Carlisle in terms of saying play with force, to me, that's not the biggest issue, but it's kind of one of those question marks, like how tough can this team be? We know Donovan Mitchell is a playoff riser. Like, he was incredible for the Cavs. He was doing everything he could to carry them, especially when they had the injuries to Garland and Mobley in that second round against Indiana, when Indiana had that incredible game two comeback. But I just feel like at some point, if I'm looking at this Cavs team, when is Evan Mobley going to become the number one guy? That to me is, I felt like they went away from him too much in closing moments. And part of that's on Mobley having to be more assertive, but he would be 10 of 12 or 10 of 13 for the game with 24 points, 12 rebounds, and then all of a sudden he doesn't touch the ball again, and it's too much hero ball with Garland and Mitchell. And I feel like this is a team that we've seen Garland now deal with injuries the last two playoffs. Can he stay healthy? I think that's a big question mark. We know Mitchell is a great player, and I just think they need to realize, like, Mobley's the guy. You mentioned it. Can he become an MVP-level player? And I think that Evan Mobley, you know, he talked about that growth after being the defensive player of the year last year. That's great. But I really think Jared Allen also took a step back in the playoffs against Indiana. I did not feel his presence out there like he should have been out there, right? So I felt like Miles Turner outplayed Jared Allen in the playoffs. I didn't feel like there was that level of toughness that we've seen from Jared before. So this is a team that I think, similar to what people are saying about the Knicks, it's make or break for this group together. They're already like, what, $87.7 million over the second apron. Like, they've invested so much money into this group. So they've got a lot of money going out, and they've got to find the results to get out of that second round. If they don't make the Eastern Conference Finals at least this year, I think, like you say, it's time to blow it up.
I wouldn't even go that far with the Cavs. I would say a targeted demolition if things flame out again for them this year. A targeted demolition, and like splitting up the front court, splitting up the back court. But I would keep Mitchell. I would keep Mobley. I want to go full blown up.
What would be really fun is a potential double reunion, right? Because they make similar salaries. What if you traded Darius Garland to the Charlotte Hornets for LaMelo Ball? You get Sexton back in Charlotte, and then you get the Ball brothers playing together with the Cavs. I mean, it might be a nice change of pace, right?
I mean, I'll tell you what. I think that type of idea Lonzo would love, and I'm sure LaMelo would love it, and I'm sure LaVar Ball also would love to see his boys play, especially if they signed LiAngelo to a two-way contract as part of the deal as well. Get all the Ball brothers together. Just talk about playing with force. Say what you want about the Balls, right? They play with force. They all do. Yeah. So, I mean, look, ultimately, I think you're spot on. Allen needs to be better come April. Like, that's for sure. Garland as well needs to be better by that point. To me, Garland's the one where I'm like, is he too small? Does his game translate to the postseason? Is he too redundant next to Mitchell? A lot of questions there. But ultimately, the swing piece is Evan Mobley. I mean, Evan Mobley, he said it at Media Day today. He's like, asked a question about, can you play at an MVP level? He's talked about the big leaps he's made each season of his career. And basically he said, yeah, I am capable of playing at that level. And Kenny Atkinson as well said it's on him in order to get Evan Mobley playing more at that level, not as a ball handler as well, putting the ball in his hands, giving him opportunities to initiate. And I think when you consider this Cavaliers team, how elite Mitchell is as a shooter off the catch, as a movement shooter, how elite Garland is as a shooter as well. And considering Mobley's ball handling ability coming from the perimeter, maybe you run small pick and rolls with Mitchell or Garland setting a screen, Mobley with the ball in his hands. Maybe you run big pick and roll with Mobley and Allen together. There's just a lot of different combinations in order to get Mobley in positions that are difficult for the defense. That's one of the layers I'd like to see added to the Cavaliers, but still it gets back to the force thing. I mean, you can do all these things with Mobley, but it does matter with the force. And does Mobley have the force as well? Does he have that characteristic to be an MVP caliber player, or is he just one of the guys? And I think this all ties in together with Mobley taking a leap that requires him playing with that force, being a guy who demands the ball, being a guy that Mitchell's like, oh yeah, I'll give it up to Evan Mobley. Like, he doesn't even need to ask for it. I know I need to give it up to him. And so I think with the Cavaliers, it's very much a personality shift I need to see from this team as much as it is a tactical shift. And those questions we won't get answers to until the regular season. Let's move on to the Detroit Pistons here. The Pistons this offseason, weird summer for them. Of course, Malik Beasley caught up in his scandal. He has been a departure. They also lose Tim Hardaway, Simone Fontecchio, and Lindy Waters. They get Caris LeVert, Duncan Robinson, Javonte Green, and they drafted Chaz Lanier out of Tennessee in the second round. So it's going to be a by-committee approach here, replacing Malik Beasley. And when you look at their rotation, a lot of the same names, very much familiar with what we saw last season with Jalen Duren, Tobias Harris, Ausar Thompson, Cade Cunningham. Getting Jaden Ivey back, that is probably the big X factor for Detroit this season after he missed the majority of last year. Can Ivy be a great shooter next to Cade as a floor spacer and B, a secondary creator, much needed next to Cade Cunningham? To me, that's one of the number one things I'll be watching for is what type of leap does Jaden Ivy take?
Yeah, I mean, last year what he played? He played 30 games, 17.6 points per game. I mean, he was really taking a step forward and then, of course, has that tough injury that keeps him out for the rest of the year. And that's basically when the Ausar Thompson came back. And Ausar Thompson came back from his blood clot injury. And that's when the Pistons really started taking off. So I think it's a combination of both Ivy and Ausar just kind of showcasing like they can be the 2-3-4 Cade Cunningham. Because Cade, to me, obviously, there's I'm curious your thoughts on this too, but there is a question if he could be the second best player in the Eastern Conference behind Giannis. I think a lot of people would probably put Jalen Brunson right there, but I think Cade showed as much in the series against the Knicks. Like, he can be one of those guys, and I think defensively he just brings it at another level than Jalen Brunson does as well. But for Jaden Ivey, I think a lot of people are curious, can he kind of fill that void that you're going to have with no Malik Beasley? Tim Hardaway Jr. was a really nice piece for them last year that fit their system exactly how they wanted it. And then I was actually a big fan of the Dennis Schroeder addition they got, and I felt like having that secondary ball handler really helped alleviate some of that pressure that you saw Cade Cunningham having to deal with before they got him. So I'm curious, can Caris LeVert and Duncan Robinson kind of fill some of those shoes with the pieces they lost? I think they can a little bit, but it's more of a lateral move than it is like a, hey, we got better with these moves. So I'm not really excited about what they have in terms of their offseason moves, but you're right. I think just the growth from their young players, Jaden Ivey, Ausar Thompson, then Jalen Duren as well. I think Jalen Duren had a nice showing in the playoffs last year, really smart to not put him on Cat Island because he would have struggled trying to guard a stretch big for the entirety of that series. But I do think that with Ivy and Duren both up for, you know, new contracts as restricted free agents, like, it's going to be a question mark of who do they want to pay, who's going to agree to a deal, and what can Jaden Ivey do? So there's a lot of question marks with their young growth, but this is all their draft picks that I think really need to take a step forward for this team to kind of maybe get into that fourth spot in the Eastern Conference and host a playoff series.
I wonder if the Pistons could end up a trade team, because they get Tobias Harris at $26 million expiring, Isaiah Stewart at $15 million this season and next season. And so there's a team option also in the third year of that deal for Stewart. So they have $41 million with just those two guys combined. They have all of their future first round draft picks. They have a number of appealing young players. Of course, you don't necessarily want to trade those guys, but Ausar Thompson, Jaden Ivey, Ron Holland, like, these guys have value in trades. And so I wonder with the Pistons, if this team, let's say Cade Cunningham does become the second best player in the Eastern Conference over the course of the first half of the year. Of course, no Halliburton, no Jason Tatum, but let's just say he surpasses some of those guys ahead of him. What if this team feels like they're just a move away? Like, why could they not be one of those teams that tries to make a big-time offer for a Lauri Markkanen type of guy with Utah when they have the salaries to make that fit, they have the pieces and the picks? To me, the Pistons are one of those teams where if Cade plays himself into, like, all-NBA lock category, they're a team that should be looking to make a move to try to capitalize off on that, to try to make a big run, because the East is wide open, man. Like, it this year, you could be just one guy away, but ultimately that is going to come down to Cade. And does Cade Cunningham continue to progress off of what he did last season when he was absolutely stellar? You know, what was he, sixth or seventh in MVP voting? Got a handful of votes for that fifth spot. Does he become a guy who's even more efficient, even better at finishing at the rim, even more consistent as a shooter off the dribble, even more versatile shooting off the catch if Jaden Ivey's going to get touches and opportunities as well? Does Cade take a leap? And suddenly, does that make the Pistons less of a cute team and more of a serious contender? To me, that's the big question here with the Detroit Pistons entering this season. And we have one more team in the Central Division here to talk about. That's the Chicago Bulls, the worst team in the division in all likelihood. But the Bulls this offseason, they lose Lonzo Ball. They bring in Isaac Okoro. Not a lot of changes with veterans. Their big changes were with the draft, taking Noah Esenge in the lottery after he fell a little bit to the back half of the lotto this year. For the Bulls, their rotation this year, a bunch of young guys, a bunch of, you know, awkward fits, a bunch of dudes where it's like you're just trying to figure out who's going to be your keepers long term. Alex, what's the number one thing you're looking for this year with the Chicago Bulls?
Oh, man, this is an interesting team. I think that it was smart of them to kind of play the hardball game with Josh Giddey and not get themselves too locked into that, because we saw what they did with Patrick Williams, and I think they're going to be kicking themselves for the next handful of years thinking about that contract. And I've even petitioned with some Bulls writers and podcasters, like, maybe he should change his name to Patrick Lee, which is his middle name, so maybe fans kind of forget about who he is, so the contract doesn't think about being such a problem for them. But I just feel like with Buzelis and the way that he kind of, you know, a leap last year, this team started playing a lot better once they traded Zach LaVine. They kind of felt like they had an identity. I think they were like 17th in offense and 17th in defense, but they were first in pace. And so they've talked a lot about kind of following that model of the Pacers and just playing fast and trying to get the ball up. So you're going to see the ball in Josh Giddey's hands a lot more. Kevin Huerter shot the ball pretty well last year. Kobe White, he's looking for a new deal as well. But I just think that with this team, you want to see that growth from Giddey and White and Buzelis, really, as your three main guys. And we'll see how much Esenge actually plays. I don't know if he'll get a lot of rotation minutes this year just because he's such a project. But, you know, Vucevic shot the ball incredibly well last year. This is a guy that probably thought he was going to get traded. But for some reason, the Bulls were asking for a first-round draft pick in return for Vucevic when they never asked for picks back in trade. So I don't know why Vuce all of a sudden got the first-round draft pick label on him. But I think he's a name to keep an eye on as someone that could get moved. And personally, for me, I know that a lot of Chicago fans probably feel the same way. If this team once again goes 39-43 and finishes 10th or 11th in the Eastern Conference, I mean, it feels like they're on the treadmill of mediocrity. They just cannot figure out a way to just make a decision of, hey, let's try to tear it down, or let's try to go make a big trade and do something. They just continue to do this whole entire thing of, hey, we're on this hamster wheel of mediocrity going nowhere. And I kind of feel like that's what this roster is right now. So hopefully some young guys will make some, you know, improvements.
It's a shame. It's a shame, Alex. It's a shame. They're the Chicago Bulls. They're the Bulls. Yeah. Like, there's a Michael Jordan statue outside the stadium. You know, of all the crappy NBA teams I've seen play in their arenas, Bulls fans are still among the loudest with their vibe in the arena, despite the team being so average. And yet they are always mediocre. And so I think it's a shame for the NBA that the Bulls continue down this path in the middle. And I hope this is a year in which, you know, Giddy takes a leap, or Manus Buzelis looks like the next big star, or, you know, Kobe White takes a leap and they decide to re-sign him to a big money deal. I hope for Bulls fans there's a light at the end of the tunnel here where it feels like they're just stuck, but not a lot of reason to feel that way over the last decade or so. And that's a real shame for a franchise that had the success and has the worldwide fame that they do. But ultimately for the Bulls, I just hope one of these young guys can pop. I hope one of them looks like an emerging star rather than, oh yeah, nice young player, but not the face of a franchise. And if that doesn't happen, I hope the Bulls are willing to trade Vooch, willing to trade Kobe White, and willing to suck, because ultimately this year's draft in 2026, there are some names at the top of the draft where if you are one of the teams that gets lottery luck and lands on the top three, and you can end up with Boozer from Duke or DeBonsa from BYU, and of course Peterson from Kansas. If you get one of those three guys, there's a chance that's your face of the franchise for the next decade plus, and that's the guy that can lead you into championship contention. And ultimately the Bulls look like one of those teams that still just wants to have a first round series and get their two home games and get their money and go home. And that's a shame. Alex, this podcast with you was not a shame. This is a lot of fun. I appreciate you joining me today, man. I wanted to do this pod today with you because you got to see John Mayer over the weekend as well. Very happy for you. I know your guitar is in the background. I got my guitars in the background as well. Very happy you got to see John Mayer live for the first time. He's amazing.
I will say it was a lot of fun to go see him live. It was actually my first time seeing him. So I think you had told me off air it had been 6 or 7 times for you. So I was like, you know what? What am I doing? I got to go see him. It's like a bucket list thing for me. And he put on a show. I mean, 14 songs was great. And honestly, like I posted probably too many videos to my Instagram story, and I was trying just to soak it in before just recording everything, because we can kind of do that. We live on our phones. But I will say, like, yeah, it's cool to see how well he continues just to be a great guitar player. And I know you're a guitar player yourself, so I'm curious with this question here. Would you say that maybe he's the best guitar player of the 21st century?
I think, for me, David Gilmour from Pink Floyd is always going to be my favorite guitarist ever. And Jimi Hendrix, I'm always going to say, is the greatest guitarist
ever. But 21st century is my question.
But 21st century, yes, I would agree. John Mayer is definitely the greatest of the 21st century. But there is a chance he is the greatest guitarist ever. I know Jason Timp from Hoops Tonight does believe he's the greatest guitarist ever. And there's an argument to be made, considering John Mayer's longevity, considering his versatility in terms of styles of music that he can play, and the fact he's still going. He's still going. Yeah. He's still only in his 50s. Hard to believe he's already in his 50s. John Mayer's got a chance if he keeps releasing great music for the next 20, 30 years, hopefully, you know, God willing, he's able to live a long, healthy life. But John Mayer's got a shot to be not just the greatest of the 21st century, but the greatest of all time.
Yeah. I was thinking about adding like songs to like tie with each team. I didn't do it, but Slow Dancing in the Burning Room, it just kind of feels like the Bucks and Giannis. I just felt like that was exactly like the greatest one. Tie those two together. I mean, maybe you could say the same thing for the Bulls, but I don't think their room's already burning. I just think for the Bucks, it's like they're slow dancing in a burning room. They're just taking their time and watching this thing burn down. But that's my little jab at the Bucks, I guess, because there is a little bit of a rivalry there with them and the Pacers. So
very, very sad. But you know what? It's a great song. It's a legendary song. In the Bucks, you know, even if they are slow dancing in a burning room, they have one of the greatest players ever on their team, and it's good that it happened.
Yes.
Well, we'll see how this goes. Alex, I appreciate you joining me today, man. Thank you so much. Please let people know where they can find your stuff.
Yeah, I'm on Twitter at AlexGoldenNBA. You can find all of our work at PacersPodSTP on all those social handles. Setting the Pace is the podcast. Cover the Pacers Monday through Friday. So if you're really interested in deep dives on the Pacers, we'd love to have you join us and talk all things Indiana basketball. But obviously a different year, not a finals contender this year. But, you know, I think they're going to be one of those teams that's just pesky to play all year long. And so we'll be covering that for you all season long.
Appreciate it, Alex. Thanks for joining me.
Thanks, Kelsey.
Big thank you again to Alex Golden for joining me on today's episode. Thanks to Emmy for producing us. Thanks to Father John Misty for the music. And thanks to you for giving us a listen. We'll be back again later this week. Have a good week, everybody. Talk soon.